This is Phil Ferrand. And I am driving home. I couldn't get my key in the car there for a second. It's like, tonk, tonk, tonk. Oh, sorry. It's Thursday today. Episode 20. I actually have a small apology to make to a friend. I was supposed to do something last week, and I didn't do it. And it may just seem like a silly little thing, but I told him that I would mention him on the podcast last week, and I didn't do it. What had happened is he had been listening to some of the podcast, and we were chatting about it. And he mentioned a podcast and attached a number to it, and I said, oh, yeah, well, that was this number. And he said, no, it was that number. And we got to comparing notes, eventually went out to the website. Turns out he was actually right, and last week I was getting ready to record episode 18 a second time. So I would have had two episode 18s and no episode 19, and that would have been bad. So I actually said, you know, it's really good we had this conversation because I was completely wrong on my numbers. And he said something about, you know, so you're going to mention it? I said, I will mention it on the podcast last week, which I didn't do. Sorry about that. Anyway, so I have atoned and made up for that. It's been a good week this week. Been a busy week this week. But this week, got to wear jeans all week. Woohoo! Because the organization that I work for is having their big convention, their biannual convention out in Orlando. And a lot of people are gone. And the bosses sent around a little memo and said, well, since we're all going to be gone, the rest of you are staying here. You can wear casuals. I mean, we were in jeans all week. I love wearing jeans. Anyways, this podcast is going to be a little bit scattered, and it's not really researched as well as I would like it to be. You know, enough with the apologies. And it's not necessarily even something I want to spend a lot of time talking about, but it's something I feel like I need to do. This is one of those need to do a podcast. And it really came about over the July 4th weekend when my wife and I were away with some of her relatives. And one of them was chatting with me and had asked, what's your new book about? Because by now they know that I go home and I write in the evenings and periodically put out books. Speaking of which, That Fated Shore, I have it submitted to createspace.com. I'm waiting for them to approve the files. And then we're getting really close to opening it up for beta. So if you happen to be listening to this somewhere around the record date, which is August the 6th, and you are interested in being a beta reader, there will be, if there isn't yet, but there will be soon, sign up on the website where you can order a beta copy for free. I will send it. I'm only going to do 100, with the caveat being that if you read it, like within the next month after you get it, write me with either corrections or suggestions or reflections, comments, anything. You just write me back after you've read the book, that I'll actually put your name in the back of the book in the acknowledgments. So, little advertisement there. Anyways, so he had asked me, What's your latest book on? And I said, well, it's a dark comedy on time travel. I said, you know, all the main characters end up dead, destitute, or deranged. But I said, really, it's about self-deception, is what it's about at the base. And they went, oh, okay. Then we went on talking about other things, and we were on to other activities. And later that day, we were walking up a hill together. And he said, so, that self-deception thing, what do you think causes that? And I said, I think it's the flesh. Because I had actually given him a copy of the book to read, and so I knew he had read the book. And I said, well, I just think it's the flesh. The flesh leads us to destroy ourselves. And you have to understand, this is a man who's very knowledgeable. He, in fact, has a doctorate in psychology. And then he asked me a question that led me to believe that maybe I hadn't communicated as well as I had hoped, because he said, so when you say the flesh, you really mean the devil. And I said, no. I said, I absolutely do not mean the devil. And he looked at me, and that led into a very good conversation. And frankly, it was a conversation I'd been wanting to have with him because, as I said, he has a lot of knowledge and has had a lot of experience in the world of working with people. And although we never really came to a full meeting of the minds in our conversation, it was a very good conversation. So ever since then, I've sort of been having the little thing going around in the back of my head about thinking, okay, when you say the flesh, and I tried to do an adequate job describing what I meant in the book, are people really hearing you say something else? And maybe you should do a podcast on what the flesh isn't. And then I should probably do a podcast on what I think the flesh is and just run the scriptures that I think support my contention that I am actually not one, I am two. And that there is a war within me between two opposite forces where one is seeking my failure and one is seeking my success. So I thought, well, that's fine, because it's interesting as you look around in philosophies in different parts of the world, there's a whole lot of contending with this idea of the war and of the struggle, and there's a lot of different ways that it gets expressed, because I think it's one of those truisms. I think we all understand at a fundamental level that there is something going on, that within us we feel the struggle. And so all these different philosophical I just completely lost the word. Philosophical schools of thought, they all have different ways of characterizing this and have different ways of dealing with it. And I think it's interesting, first of all, to see that a lot of philosophy deals with this idea of contentiousness that we experience within us, and they all have different approaches, but none of them are quite what I think. None of them are quite what I believe, and so I thought it would be a good exercise for just to go around and visit these different things and see how what I'm proposing is actually a little bit different from those. For instance, if you look at Hinduism, and I am not an expert on any of these other schools of thought, just done a little bit of reading, what I've picked over, certainly I could be completely misrepresenting them, these other schools of thought, and if I am, I very much stand to be corrected, but I will do my best to characterize what I think is what is actually being put forth in these different schools of thought. One of them, in Hinduism, for instance, in Sanskrit, if I recall correctly, the word for ego is actually roughly translated eye-maker. And in Hinduism, the concept of ego is that thing which is expressed in selfishness, that thing which is expressed in anger, in desire, in wanting our own way, in pursuing our own things. And the Hindu would say that the works, what I would call the works of the flesh, you know, anger, lust, greed, jealousy, that those are manifestations of ego. And ego, it's pretty close. You know, when you hear Hindus talk about ego and what it's doing and how it causes us to think that we are separate from each other, and it increases isolation and denies community and all those types of things. I mean, there are some things in there that I hear Hindus talk and I go, yeah, that's pretty close. Likewise, Buddhism has this concept of I, and in Buddhism, the Tibetan word for ego is grasping to a self. Now, Buddhism really makes a point of saying, well, there is no true I. that in order to live in the present, you really have to completely abandon this concept of I, that I is simply a slave to the senses, and that our troubles and our struggles arise from this concept of I, me, my. The Dalai Lama said something to the effect that the common enemy of all religious disciplines is selfishness of the mind. For it is just this which causes ignorance, anger, passion, which are at the root of all the troubles in the world. Now, you know, that's there's an element of that that I think accurately portrays what's going on when I talk about flesh. It's also interesting to me that yogi, in the discipline of yoga, that the yogis, at least from some of them that I've read, are a little bit more relaxed in this concept of self and the need to completely obliterate self. But there's some cool stuff that I've read that sounds very much absolutely right to me. There was one meditation teacher that I stumbled across this week. Her name was Sally Kempton. And she talked about the fact that yogis have always grappled with this paradox of getting the right, as I understood what she was saying, getting the right balance of ego. And she said the ego, which loves any form of self-improvement, is especially eager to take on projects for getting rid of itself, which that's true. The ego is like, oh, yeah, that'll help you do much better with, you know, this anger that you're struggling with. Yeah, let's do that, you know, because it likes to go into hiding as you do all those things. And then you feel like, oh, I'm really making some progress here, because all it's done is dropped back and gone into hiding. And then just when it wants to continue now with her quote, she said, it will earnestly set itself up to get bashed and then pop up like a piece of half-toasted bread as if to say, look at me, haven't I practically disappeared? Well, you know, I can relate to that because I have seen that. I had a buddy who was having, he was divorced and he was having difficulties with his ex-wife. Well, then my buddy finally starts dating someone else, and all of a sudden, his ex-wife gets religion. You know, all of a sudden, she cleans up her act, and she's going to church, and she's doing this, doing that. And I was talking to my buddy, and I said, you know, problem here is that you don't really know if she's really cleaned up her act, or this is like one of those foxhole conversions. You know, all of a sudden, her flesh is saying, oh, you know what? Best way for us to stir up to trouble is just to drop back. So it drops back and things get real spiritual, and there's so much spiritual talk about how I feel like a new person and everything's wonderful, except at the worst possible moment, it's going to come driving back in, sticking its heels in, and wham, it's coming back. So what is bound up in all of those philosophies of thought, though, in Hinduism and Buddhism and of course, yoga and the yogiism, I don't know if that's a word, there is the concept of ego in those things as something that needs to be dismissed and something that is somewhat illusionary. It doesn't really exist. I mean, Buddhists and Hindus, I believe, will both say that the ego and the I really don't exist, that they're only illusions. In fact, I read one quote by a Hindu that said that the ego is like a stick that is drugged through the water, and the trough that it leaves is like the ego. It's only an illusion. And it misses the point that it's all water. And especially in Hinduism, and I believe in Buddhism, the bottom line is that we are all part of God, we are all God, and it is only our egos that keep us from realizing that. And that's where I differ from those schools of thoughts, because I don't believe at the base and bottom of it all, that I am God. I firmly believe that I have the spark of God within me. I firmly believe that the Spirit of God communicates with me. But I also firmly believe that God, in the wonder of His creation, has actually created me as a separate identity. So I am not Him, nor will I ever be, but I was created to be able to be in communion with Him. So that's kind of where this whole idea of flesh and spirit, in my mind, departs from the Hindu idea, the Buddhist idea, and the idea of the yogis. Another possibility people might find some resonance with when I talk about flesh and spirit is in the Chinese philosophy of yin-yang. And even though the Chinese philosophy of yin-yang is really more about balance in the world and how there are forces which operate in mutually exclusive ways that create a whole, and it's not necessarily just good versus evil, it has, because of the symbology connected with it, black versus white on the little, circle with the two teardrop things in them, it has been equated somewhat with this idea of that good and evil will always be clashing, and they are both parts of the same whole. And when I talk about flesh and spirit, it's not really from that philosophical stance either. I'm not really talking about some kind of yin-yang thing. Because in the yin-yang, things are balanced. And both sides are equally balanced, and they're part of the whole, and I don't believe that. I believe that my flesh is a corrupted entity that is actually weaker than my spirit and only succeeds through trickery. And I could get along just fine without it. I could have all the passion that I need to get things accomplished that I need. I could have all the strength. I could have everything that I need in this life to get along great and accomplish my epic without having the flesh tacked onto the top of it. So in that sense, I'm not really, yin-yang. The other possible school of thought, if we want to get more secular, is to classify the flesh as id, out of the Freudian idea. In the Freudian idea, you have the id, and it's the base animalistic desires, the primitive lust and drives. And then you have the superego, which is the more mature, the moral conscience. It's the thing which desires good. And then you have the ego in the center that sort of runs traffic cop between the two of those. And my concept of flesh is not really id, because it's easy for us to dismiss the id as simply a bunch of base desires that we just have to suppress all our life, and we'll never be able to stop them, we'll never be able to understand them, whereas my concept of flesh is that it's not really that, it's really an enemy that plans, and that it has a purpose in everything it's driving to. It's not just want, it has a desire to cause us to fail. And so I think that's different than what Freud was talking about. What's interesting, I really didn't have the time to do enough research on Islam to see how Islam characterizes this thing that's going on inside us. But just from what little reading that I did, Islam does appear to have this concept of the war within. But I didn't really get far enough into it to see if there would be a difference between how they would characterize it, where it comes from, and how I would characterize it. The other thing that I am not, and I said this in my conversation over the 4th of July weekend, I am not a Gnostic. When I say flesh and spirit, I don't mean physicality and spirit. I don't mean, I'm getting my mail. I don't mean, my body is so evil and my spirit is so good, and if I could just get my body under control, then everything would be great. I saw enough of that in the Philippines. As I've said before, I grew up in the Philippines, and one of the things that happened every Easter is we had the flagellantes. And what the flagellantes were, you had men who were doing penance, and so they would strip down to the waist, and they would lay on the ground, and there would be a board, and it had either broken glass or some razor blades on it, and they would tap their backs and make cuts in their backs. Someone would do that for them. And then they would have this whip, and they would walk through the streets, whipping themselves and causing the blood to flow on their backs and punishing themselves because they were trying to atone by punishing their body. There would be a guy, and he would actually be crucified. And there's a long history of this in the Christian church, this sort of Gnostic idea that flesh is evil and spirit is good. And specifically, when we talk about flesh, the physical world, the material world is evil. I'm backing into my garage. And I'm not a Gnostic. I don't believe that. What I believe about the world is that the world is wonderfully designed. I believe my body is wonderfully designed. And that things really work very, very well here. And the only reason they don't work well is because we humans are messing it up. And so I have a great deal of respect for nature and for the wonders of nature. And so I really can't be a Gnostic in that kind of classical sense. And of course, the last and final thing that I'll just mention is the question that started this whole thing, and that is, I do not believe that the flesh is the devil. One of the easiest scapegoats, I think, that we can have in our lives is to just say, oh, the devil made me do it. Oh, the devil's really been after me this week. And frankly, I think the flesh just loves that. Because then it can get you to externalize the enemy. And if it can get you to externalize the enemy, then it can hide. Oh, that evil devil. But one of the just basic problems that I have with calling the flesh the devil, aside from the fact that there are three enemies described in Scripture to us, and next week, I actually need to take some time to run some of the scriptures about the flesh and see how the flesh is characterized. And I'll talk about more how over the years we have tended to take those characterizations and water them down and make them mean things other than what they say if you just take them at face value. Aside from the fact that scriptures mention all of these other enemies, that we have the world, the flesh, and the devil that are allied against us, the main problem that I have with the devil, per se, being the one who's tearing us up, is I just don't think he's that powerful. I mean, when you think about it, there are, what, 6 billion people in the world? And I don't know about you, but people who are really living in the spirit, frankly, they are few and far between that I can see. I have not encountered many people in my lifetime of all religious persuasions, including Christians, who truly live in the spirit. I see this war going on in people all around me. And if the devil is the one who's causing it, that means that he's pretty much doing that in 6 billion people nearly simultaneously. Now, I know some people would say, well, it's not the devil, it's his demons. The demons are after me. Well, okay. But still, that's a lot of manpower or devil power or demon power or something. And I just don't think the devil and his demons are that powerful. There's that many of them. I think there's just something going on. And I think when it gets right down to it, you can look across all of the philosophical schools of thought. You can look in pop culture. You can look anywhere that you want to look in terms of anyone who's thinking or anyone who's trying to characterize our existence. And I don't think you have to look very far to find this idea that there's a war going on within each of us. And that it's not an external war. It's really an internal war. And it was in trying to make sense of that internal war that I was grousing to God. And I feel like the Holy Spirit communicated to me an idea that helped me make sense of what was really going on inside. And that's where Still Whispers came from, and that's where the whole framework came from. So next week, what we're going to do is we're going to do what I never did in Still Whispers, because I was really interested. I knew, I got to wrap this up, wrap it up, Phil. I knew just from looking and from listening to culture and from other schools of thought that this idea of the war and this idea of this contention within us was an idea that would resonate enough that I didn't necessarily need to track it all the way into the explicit passages that talked about that. But, you know, it probably would be a good idea to do that next week. So next week, we will do that. In the meantime, have a great weekend. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.